I like the directness. I like the, you don't like it. You're...
and then the actual language of the code with any of the proposals highlighted. And then you'll also see that at the end of this like, page, on page 25, we put so many good ideas and reflections and really helpful reflections from people's experiences that we thought it was wise and really useful to add this recommendation to organizational change about cars with the language code. This really was a kind of systemic analysis that we were doing with people at the programs and the various stuff that we had, but we're not sort of technical issues. As the changes to the code actually improve, make substantive improvements, but also outside the code, those are substantive that we do not link to organizational changes. We also note in the code various places where we do have agreements, either substantially or exactly the kind of working topic with the president's committee on as we get what it's called the future. Yeah, whatever the committee was for the president has worked with. So we made reference to that. I also would mention that on page 5, I know I've emphasized it before, but I do want to emphasize it now. On page 5 of our overview, we note that our recommendations came from listening to people rather than going through the process with preconceived notions that we took them up. That takes time to do, and it takes a lot of effort. And I think it's well worth it. There are some situations where we don't have option, we have to be option C. Depending on the strategy in the Congress, we felt that this sort of work coming out of the trauma that people experience on campus, that required a campus discussion where our recommendations came from that sort of broad community engagement. And it may have taken a little longer than I've been trying to think of the plan, but I think actually it moved the committee towards a consensus somewhat in here that maybe we wouldn't have had that. But I do think it was a very constructive way to do this kind of work. And I think that what we emerged with this report reflects a real consensus that came on what we could do at the committee when we put together. I think the most extensive, as one can imagine, most extensive recommendations for changes in terms of history in the highlighted parts is page 12. Actually, it starts on page 10 and goes to page 15. And this has to do with issues of arrest and stalking and assault, where in ways that overlap but are not exactly the same as the task force, we recommend making changes to Title 3, Article 2A1, that we draw from the sterling policies of sexual harassment, there's a broader sexual harassment. So those changes we thought were very important to make, and they're reflected in the actual code, suggested code language, of course, which the committee did look at carefully. And in addition to that, we recommend, as you can see at the bottom of page 13, that the CJC creates, in conjunction with others, creates guidances, including a guidance on harassment and hostile environment to be added as an appendix to the code in order to have more interpretive materials that are meant to be the language, but they can also refer to the interpretation and guidance about the meaning of different terms as well as areas that are not going to be designated or prohibited as the actual speech. So we thought that trying to form that into a code is going to be too kind of weighed down because you made it would not be clear. This kind of separate interpretive guidance. There are other places in our recommendations that we recommend interpretive guidance, like I said, but that's where all this one have. And then the other one, which is going to be, I think, a real heavy lift to consider, is following now, I think, 16, and that is to bring, for the CJC to consider whether policy 6.4 on sexual harassment should be brought back into the code or at least closer to the code. So our recommendation on the provision on harassment would be decided that it should be closer to the code, which she certainly heard a lot of concern and dissatisfaction with how separate the code is from 6.4. So we don't have any recommendations for specific language on that, but that's really cool with policy. Let's see, I mean, I think I've talked enough. I don't know if you have questions. Oh, one thing I want to ask is that I haven't said this to anybody except for staff, but I think one thing we should consider is when and how to distribute this more broadly, including certainly the members of the administration. I have said that, assuming that was appropriate for this group. To consider. And then also, we want to make sure one of the things we talked about in the last committee meeting was to act and publicize what we've done here and really put this out to the community. And one of the members of our group has volunteered to start drafting a press release. And so I think that is something that is very important for us to continue that community engagement to see it and have easy access to it.
So first off, thank you and the rest of you, by the way, for this kind of time. It truly is a huge undertaking. But thank you for you carrying it, coordinating all of it. And it was an exhaustive process. I personally agree. I think it came to turn out an excellent result. In terms of next steps, I've already spoken with the office in terms of figuring out how do you want to put a website. We still have current pages that kind of for last year for the group. So in terms of turning those more to archival, and then saying, here's what happened, and here's the final product, and in a way that makes it clear, because the prior work, I mean, in essence, there are prior things such where people would engage in systematic examination of parts of the code or parts of Canvas, where the either report gets lost over time, or the deliberations are separate from the report, and in 3 or 4 years, you don't want people to be scratching their heads going, what happened in the reinventing the wheel. So I've already spoken to the office on that in terms of doing it. I know, and I mentioned, I think, at our last meeting, President Pollock is coming to the University Assembly this coming Tuesday, October 16th. So if you wanted to put this on the agenda for the next coming Tuesday, it would be, I know the full Assembly has an interest in it, and additionally would coincidentally line up with the President coming, which you might find fortuitous, and that'll have to speak to the committee. And in terms of other publicity, I think that's really it. I know we'd also talked about potentially having it within the Cornell Chronicle community, or some way to attract formalized attention, again, also to create a record that this happened, here's what happened, here's the report, such that people can see it. If they feel like they want for now, or they want to see it a month, 2 months, a year, etc.
Will you be able to answer this at the University?
Yes.
And would you be willing, I don't think it's going to happen, but if this committee objects to any language that's currently in the report, would you be okay with us amending it before it's presented next to the work?
Well, I guess that's up to this group. I mean, it seems to me that it's so close to the 16th now that perhaps just having the report as put into the CJC makes some sense. You know, I mean, based on the speed at which, you know, amendments oftentimes get passed or don't get passed, I'm assuming that it's unlikely that we would have something that soon, but maybe you have something specific.
No, I'm in agreement with you, but yeah. In case anybody in this room does object to anything strongly, I think that should be the question's before it goes to the
Assembly.
This committee.
Yeah, I don't think it's up to me to object. My preference would be to say that it's logical at this point to say, here's the working group's report, and that the CJC will be considering it.
I would echo that. In terms of why I see it is we, this committee, the UA, created in charge of the working group to go out and do something. They have not done it, given us a report. That report is their product. If the CJC concurs with it, we can, I mean, that's the CJC has the ability, in my estimation, to concur with it. If you don't like something, we can say we concur except for this. I wouldn't personally, in the body, it's great. I would say we don't necessarily want to amend the report because the report isn't ours. It's coming to us. We can note places we may agree or disagree. I think it's a much more point something as we can discuss it. But I think the report being presented is from the group, and therefore it's what we survey. If they recommended it, I would rather say, here it is. The CDC either hasn't, has reserving judgment, has concurs, doesn't concur, or something else.
Does anybody else have any comments or issues?
Well, I would just say, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, that this report is this report, and then what this committee does with it is up to this committee, but it, yeah, it doesn't amend the report. It's a nice one, some people go, oh, yeah, honey.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Well, it happens more often.
Take it, but it happens.
That exhausts the speaker's list for discussion on the report. Anybody else have any comments?
Well, I have, so you, I didn't know, like, when was the time to, like, actually comment on content, because, like, so you mentioned, like, bringing policy 6.4 closer, like, what would that look like in the policy? Like, would that, because the way it's structured is, like, wonky as it is right now, would that just be, like, as a university culture around it, change it, or would that be, like, a formalization inside of the code? What would you, like, think?
So do you want me to start from the standpoint of the committee? You know, we really weren't exactly sure, and so I think to some extent our recommendations do that, bring it closer by taking much of the language from 6.4 and importing it.
Yeah.
We felt like this was such a major question beyond doing that. That is, you know, should 6.4 remain separate? Should it be brought, you know, explicitly back into the code? That this was such a major issue that we weren't really in a position to make a definitive recommendation on that because there are so many aspects to what to do with another a policy that's outside the code, how it got there, you know, the kinds of changes that would be made, potentially to Title IX.
Yeah.
We really didn't know exactly what to do, but we did feel that there was enough dissatisfaction and confusion about 6.4, that it was, if this is an appropriate moment for this, the CJC and others to be considering how to create more of a seamless kind of an approach for people to be able to find regulations and policies and prohibitions easily so that they are not searching in multiple places.
Good, a way to kind of bring 6.4 closer to the code, or I guess this change would bring the code closer to 6.4, would be on that issue of quantum approved.
That's a big question, Mark,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we have the clear and convincing evidence standard in the code, that's the preponderance of evidence standard in 6.4. There's certainly the likelihood that there will be a longer debate about that issue, that, you know, which way to go. The current Trump administration, Betsy DeVos's position is that you should have one standard that everybody follows, and it could be either one.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be discussed in that.
Michelle?
Yeah, I think two questions. One of them was, when we were talking about the 6.4 and the standard proof, it seemed like from this report there was a clear indication that our community wanted accountability for acts that really did to bias and things of that nature. So was there any conversation about how having a higher standard of proof actually prevents that accountability from occurring?
I don't recall any discussion about that specifically. It looks like Matt may have some recollection about that, but I don't recall us ever talking about actually lowering the standard. And there were a lot of ways that what people seem to be asking for was greater clarity about how decisions are made, more reporting back, a greater understanding of the community about what the penalties that were potential penalties we used, how sentencing was carried out, you know, the kinds of the ingredients. But I don't recall any discussion about lowering the standard of proof.
On that, there was a little bit of discussion around the next version, our next proposal, which was 17, which in essence bringing Greek life back under the code. The Greek system had spoken informally to the assembly, in essence, saying they were looking to come back under the code. The president of the task force had a similar recommendation to go under the code and bring back somewhere under the umbrella. So there was a little bit of discussion around there, and they did speak to the UA about it. But I think I really agree with Reese, there really wasn't much. It didn't really come up. In terms of the accountability, and Rochelle and you and I have had this conversation before, I personally agree with the district coast counselors that accountability and the quantum of proof are not necessarily linked. I believe that you can hold people accountable once you are sure they've done something, and I believe that the quantum of proof is not necessary. A lower quantum of proof is not holding people accountable, it's about ensuring that innocent individuals are not unfairly punished. And on the flip side, ensuring that when you are certain someone has done something, you can give them a harsher sanction because you know it's less likely you're making a mistake. But setting that aside, to raise the point, there was minimal discussion about it. And in terms of the 6.4 process, when the 6.4 last major overhaul was 2015-2016, the individuals doing it at the time, Carol Grumbach and John Silcano, were excellent. They really did a really good job coming to all the assemblies. I met them a number of times. They expressed an interest at the time to try and bring the code, or 6.4, closer to the code in terms of having robust procedures. Obviously, with the Title IX environment, for lack of a better word, it's flipping based on who Bush administration the United States has, which could lead to some interesting changes. But there was talk about, could we bring some complaints about, could we mirror that to the code? The UA talked about that last year, there's some communications, but in essence, there, at least in the past, has been an indication on both sides about how we can try and merge where it makes sense, we'll still be keeping them. Merge where it makes sense, I think that's the way to do it. What we've talked about in the past. Obviously, what will happen in the future is open, but the assembly previously was open to that. The 6.4 policy office was previously open to that. But in terms of ensuring that there's clarity, at least there is clarity around what goes where, is something that's better. The code does technically consider a provision that the intent of the assembly when it was pulled out was to bring it back eventually, whether or not that is politically or physically viable anymore is another question, but in the intent to change, and that was the intent when it was carved out on the versus basis around 2011.
Is that intention noted anywhere? That would be
it's appendix, one of the appendixes says, I believe appendix A says that, in essence, these versions are 6.4 until such time as the code can be brought to compliance. The resolution of time was written by Jim Blair, who was the vice chair of the assembly, but they wanted to be chair. And that goes through and explains how the UA believed it should be under the code. The UA time discussions were very much the UA really wanted to keep the quantum group where it was. And that's the full discussion that occurred. And obviously, the legal environment is why it was pulled, because we were raising OCR and Department of Education.
True. On the note of Greek life, they are going through their full judicial reform review right now by a separate committee, which I'm on. And Charlie's on, Chris Schaefer's on, Christine Liang is on, Jay's office. So there's a chunk of people put out already to look at that. They're going to be making their rounds through shared governance here pretty soon. Mary Beth Grant has contacted me and Gina, and she's going to make her rounds throughout the assemblies. So that should be on people's docket. So that's something that I think this committee will eventually might see after we go through our whole entire gap analysis, which is going to be this whole year, which is what it looks like. On the, you had a second question.
Go ahead.
On the note of, I think, standard of proof with Greek life, it's really up in the air again. There is at a lower level than the code, same as policy 6.4, but I think there is a criticism there to be made of when they do get in trouble, do you get to actually get them in trouble? Like, when they, like, do you actually get to, like, bring teeth into that conversation? Because as it stands right now, there's not a lot of teeth that OSFL has in Greek life. So I think there is a good conversation. If they do come with a code, I think it's going to provide discongruence with, I mean, unless you want to have different standards of proof, like if it's identity-based harassment amongst these identities, to square that with policy 6.4, and then if you want to put it at hazing and organizations at different standards of proof, but then that's automatically going to get messy with how do you separate potentially an identity-based hazing violation. But that, I think that would be more of a question, I think, for the JA's office. Your second question.
So kind of just 2 points. I have a lot of substantive thoughts, but I'm curious what other people think. I do like the part where you talk about having ADR for kind of non-code violations. I think the thing that this committee will need to think about when we have that conversation is there's no non-compliance part of the code besides technical. And so the idea of having the independent board and call someone in to say, look, y'all aren't getting along and there's not a code provision, but you're harming our community, there's no enforcement mechanism. And so I think that's one of the challenges. And so locally, you don't have that quote unquote mean dean conversation, right? There's no enforcement for that. So I think that's one of the things that was in the report that I think we do need to have a conversation about. What kind of struck me the most is page 19, where it's talking about sanctioning guidelines and setting penalties. So I'm very curious to understand where that came from, because we're actually pretty streamlined when it comes to sanctions. The first time alcohol looks very similar to, you know, that. So I'm curious about the thoughts, if it's something that I just haven't communicated clearly. I don't know if anybody can understand that, but the deviance actually comes from the hearing reports. So you can share some of the conversations that were in place with that.
Yeah. Actually, I would go out of order on two, so I don't know if you're spoken yet.
Oh, sorry. I just want to jump on the conversation around the quantum proof and wondering if there's an opportunity for discussion. I kind of hear what Joseph was saying about, well, we could get messy, but by way of example, our personnel, internal affairs, when someone comes to us with a complaint, one of our officers, it's basically four things. It can be unfounded, didn't happen. It can be not sustained, which goes more towards that preponderance, but not quite up to clear and convincing. Like something happened here, and we need to address it. And there's a level of addressing we can have. Then there's founded, and then that brings in the more the clear and convincing standard. And then there's exonerated, which means obviously there's something that happened, but the person wasn't at fault. But so the policies and procedures were found. And different levels of discipline or address based on how certain you are that someone, it offers more opportunity to address the issue, where it feels like whatever quantum we choose, we get locked in this on-off switch. You either have it or you don't, as opposed to, well, we have enough to do this, but not enough to do that. So I would like to throw it out there to consider matrixing it versus on-offing it, and that allows better conversation to be had, maybe without, you know, getting out branding there and marking up transcripts and things.
Yeah, and actually, I thank you. That's goes to me. That's what I was going to say related to actually Michelle's question in terms of even reading some of the hearing board's decisions recently. A lot of the some hesitancy to actually note where the hearing board wanted to impose a certain sanction, but were concerned with the record retention timeline. And in essence, they saw it as a deterrent because they saw the record retention and the reportability of it as something that would be higher than they wanted to go. Well, and therefore, they ended up amending the sanction to a lower sanction because of the shorter retention timeline. And I think a lot of that, in terms of the sanctioning, having some predictability, I know, Michelle, you've been very clear about it, but ensuring, I guess, my understanding of what was talked about in the work group was ensuring that it's easier to find and attached to the code, and also ensuring that there's a community element of the community thinks the following should be here, and then to have that discussion. It's not, and that was what came forward out of the committee and talking with the community. And it also, it ties in a little bit to even my reading of hearing board decisions where people are talking about the long-term effect of sanctions. In terms of something like ADR, I think it was very well received. I mean, I remember, I've been a huge supporter of it. I remember all the way back when you were interviewing with this position, it was something that jumped out at us then, and is. I personally think this past pilot year was excellent. I'm really glad it's been expanding. I think it's formalized into the code because it's in the president, frankly, and has publicly stated her task force has also endorsed that. In terms of the Greek life, I mean, my understanding was the Greek system liked the fact that the code has teeth to it, but it also has a higher quantum proof, so you have to be certain something happened. And again, it fits into the, if we're willing to look at more of a a sliding scale, I think that would be potentially useful. I think it also ties into what are lasting effects, because I think if you want to have an educational part of the code, telling someone, oh, it's going to be put in a record for 6 years or however, and obviously if you agree to it, that can start overshadowing towards the more punitive aspect. I mean, in terms of the Greek life system, I've had a conversation with the president. She said her group is looking at it. I told her flat out, I think the CJC should look at it concurrently, and we likely would, and that it does relate to code. Putting them under dean of student's office seems a little interesting, because, to be honest, the reason the code was put under community stewardship was the administration had a shot in the 60s, and they blew it. I mean, there were deans tossing people out for non-compliance, or you're protesting, or we don't like this. And it really backfired, and the board said, okay, we're going to have some, in essence, the community have much more of a role in it. And then it fits into the non-compliance. I mean, there is non-compliance in the code for issues of public order and, I believe, public safety. The McBride case really reaffirmed that it really is in that area. This committee last year, we talked about non-compliance with sanctions. I think the committee agreed with that. I think in terms of a blanket non-compliance, something that in my past experience, prior committees have been very concerned about, precisely because if a dean says, I want to have a tough conversation with someone, well, maybe they don't think there's a code provision, but maybe they're just in essence trying to, oh, it's harming our community. Well, there's no appeal then. It's in essence, it's justice dispensed by a dean. And whereas I trust all the deans I've ever encountered here, the whole point we have a system is so that there's some formality, and that you can't have someone sanctioned for a dean saying, I don't want you to do this. This person saying, well, code isn't prohibited, I want to do it, and then being sanctioned for violating what the dean said, not the fact that doesn't actually violate the code. It seems to be a back door in terms of you can expand the code greatly if you allow a dean or an administrator to say, you may not do the following without it being in the code. I mean, if we want to have some more wiggle room around there, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think a lot of this report, and even the working group, the discussion was about there needs to be more discussion. And that things such as that are very large discussions, and having an idea of where we're coming from. Because I think everyone agrees that our code is unique, that our system is, I'm a fan of the system. I'm guilty as charged in that case. But I think there's a lot of understanding that our system has a lot of strengths, but that there's a strong tradition of presumption of innocence, there's a strong presumption of community involvement, and even the community in Greek life. I mean, I'm happy to welcome them to the UA, but outside of my conversations directly with the president, I haven't been formally involved at all, which is interesting because it's concerning that the UA hasn't been asked to formally appoint someone. Yes, Joe's on it, he's a member of the UA, but it's different when the UA is formally looped in. And this happens a lot with president companies. I don't fault the president, and I think this committee is bullshit to work with them. But there is a difference when it's community driven versus administration driven. And even our the working group and our president.
Yeah. So some reflections on things that have been brought up. Let's start with the Greek life piece. That was the idea of bringing the Greek system under jurisdiction of the code was something where we didn't hear anything but that it was a good idea. Put it more positively, everybody thought that was a good idea. And to some extent, it was what the university is stating. Who is part of the community and who should be held responsible for who should be held into accountability under the code. That it made no sense to anybody that we talked to, including everybody on the committee, to exclude the Greek community. In terms of the standard of proof in that case, I think that what's been said already is very relevant, the issue of that there's actually teeth in the code. The standard of proof would be the same for Greek life as for everybody else, but that there would be less self-regulation in a way that would enable us, the community, to believe that the Greek organizations are being held responsible for what they do by somebody else. Now, one thing to keep in mind and that we talked about was that this does not prevent the Greek organizations from self-regulating, right? They can have regulations internally that are stricter than the code, that have a lower standard of proof. And so there's nothing mutually exclusive about bringing them under the code and having them self-regulate. Okay, so that's one piece. Another piece about your specific question, Michelle, about the guidelines for sentencing. One of the things, and this is on page, I'm looking at page 19 here. One of the things that we point out about sentencing is that we recognize that we've got two approaches, sometimes which seem to be in conflict, and that is an approach for individualized sentencing, which I'm certainly very in favor of, in terms of ordering a due process to say that we look at each individual case and we recognize that you should do individual sentencing based on those that situation, and at the same time that once you have guidelines so that the community, including the person being sentenced, as well as the community that's affected by, you know, the kinds of things that we were talking about here, sexual harassment, sexual assault, that the community feels that there's an even-handedness and a predictability about sentencing. So I don't think that this was put in there as a criticism of what was being done as much as that, because what we kept hearing was we need more transparency, predictability, and openness and community education and reporting to the community, that this would be a way where if we had guidelines that were put out to the community, that then the community could read, as well as the hearing boards could read, that this would be a way to try to increase transparency and predictability and even-handedness at the same time that it keeps in the hearing boards the ability to have individualized sentencing. And I think that what we were hearing was that people didn't really know how sentences were determined. Even if, like as you said, well, it's been done in a way that is designed to do just those goals that I just described, that there was, what we heard was an expression of a desire to have more information for the public about how it's been done. Okay. The other thing I wanted to address that's been that Michelle and others have raised is the ADR issues. And what we were hearing there was what we expressed in terms of gray areas. Right? And some of those gray areas could be specifically related to potential code violations, and some could be, as you say, outside the code. And I think it speaks to, Kathy, what you were saying as well, that what we were hearing and what we wanted to express in this report was kind of the educational side of the code. And I know that, you know, we have those discussions about, is this an educational document? Is it more of a kind of a punitive-based document? And, you know, as you know from our prior discussions, my position is that this is a code where it has potential penalties and it makes it kind of a punitive document. But that we also recognize from what we're hearing that there was a sense of, like, what you were saying, like, okay, may not reach a standard proof, but there's a problem that's come out here. That's that gray area. So can we have proactive measures as well as responsive measures in those gray areas where we can avoid the next issue that comes up where it actually looks into a full-blown code violation or actually address perhaps interrelational problems? And that's where kind of the ADR focus is what we were emphasizing. And that had a lot of support from the people we were talking about, the idea of really dealing in more of this educational realm when appropriate. And then one final thing, James Wilson raised, is the standard proof issue. And it goes back to something that Matt was saying, I think you, Joe, you were raising as well. And that is that what we were hearing and that what everybody on our committee agreed with was that this is a moment where we actually have to confront this, right? We've been sort of doing the proverbial kicking the can down the road with really different standards of proof for sexual harassment as opposed to something which is racial harassment. And what do you do when you have the intersection of race and sex with regard to harassment and assault? You know, that we have these two different standards. That's really not satisfactory. And there are very strong arguments that I agree with to keep the standard of proof very high. And that's a bigger discussion for us to have. I mean, it goes, shorthand version of it is that in an actual court where we have a public trial, and where we have other due process protections in terms of being represented fully by an attorney and having appeals of a certain kind, all the due process protections that we, you know, connect with action being in the courtroom, that in a civil suit of that kind, you can have the preponderance of evidence. Whereas in a situation like we have on campuses, including our code, where you have, we don't have all those due process protections, that the clear and convincing evidence standard can act as one of a proxy for making sure that we have reliable and accurate determinations and outcomes. So that's a much bigger discussion than certainly what we're going to have here today. But I think that what we did here was a consensus that it's time for us to actually do on this issue.
Are you
fine? Sure.
Yeah, so I think with kind of touching on ADR and then the standard group, yeah, because I feel like that's kind of the same. With ADR, and I think what the GM Students Office is having to do with ADR is going to be in a functional different capacity than what the JA's office might do with ADR. And I'm not sure about that process because at least the Dean of Students one is still being built out as it currently speaks. I mean, Love Kamui is fantastic at understanding ADR because of great background, but to the degree of the buy-in of the current student body with the Dean of Students one is extremely minimal, where the one with the OJA is, I think, one that students didn't really buy into, but they're all like, okay, this is a different idea than what we really see. So I think they serve as two functionally very different types of ADR. With the JA's office, it's a different, it's like instead of going to this hearing board process, let's go through ADR, let's kind of do that. Because with the hearing board, both parties automatically kind of agree to go through that whole entire thing. And so that's why the ADR works with the OJA. Where ADR sometimes might fail in the Dean of Students office is that two parties involved in a bias incident, many times going through the Dean of Students office, would not be willing to go through ADR. There would be many times where I think students with marginalized identities would not feel like going through ADR would benefit them through the process. If anything, it would just make them relive the whole entire traumatic incident. So that's, I think, a functionally different part of it, and it's still something that's being built out. So they serve in two similar capacities, but at the same time, two very different, and I think that's where conversations amongst lower level peer review board, and you note this in like residential halls, like where those issues in the classroom might do really great with the Dean of Students one, but necessarily if there is something that the student's like, no, I want this student to understand what happened to me and I already filed a JA, let's go through the JA process and do it. So it provides alternative avenues for students and also provides a good alternative avenue if it's a faculty or staff member through the JA's office, where the Dean of Students office does not have that capacity really to do that. On the standard of evidence, I would really love to see, and I think going forward, the issue with trying to think about the standard of evidence, what might change is the fact that there's not a lot of public and transparent cases around Greek life, which is something that we requested in the Greek Judicial Reform Committee. But also, I think it would be really interesting to see those near misses of the UHRBs that might have, like, if the standard of evidence was tweaked just slightly, would there be a difference? And where are those cases going through, and how can this committee actively look at that data pool and say, if we change the standard of proof in the campus code of conduct around lowering to this policy 6.4, here's the differences that would walk out with trying to move standard proof up and if 6.4 moves up, that's a whole different thing that it's really hard to get data on those cases. But I think that's something that would be really compelling for a lot of people to see. Would this change any effects in sanctioning for students in the JA's office or in Greek life or in whatever? Because then I think that creates a good compelling argument when we need to deal with it. Because right now it's just two feelings, and I think kind of being able to see, well, this would have been different, I think would be really great.
On the speakers list, I have Matt and Michelle. And if anybody has anything that they want to move on to the next section of the speakers list, please feel free to raise your hand or placard for that. We're going to have to probably at the next meeting come forward with an actual concrete plan for the rest of the semester and the rest of the year and how we're going to tackle all of these amendments. That includes these amendments that are proposed by the working group as well as those from the President's Task Force, anything that might come out of this Greek Judicial Reform Committee in the coming months, and that's going to be a lot that we don't exactly have a set way that we have to deal with that. There's been a discussion about whether or not we want to rewrite the code completely discussion about reformatting the code, discussion about setting these amendments through first and then bring about reformatting the code. We also have the rejected housekeeping amendments from the spring that we are going to probably want to repass in some form. Many of those are very important. I know that we are actually almost harming the judicial administrator's office by not having those passed yet. So if you have any other comments about that, you're welcome to move into that discussion.
I guess I'll try and be brief, just try and not reinvent the wheel. I think the ADR point of view, I think what Joe raised, I think the dean of students having a different ADR in terms of people want to sit down and discuss what happened and have a neutral third party. If they're both voluntary, I think it's excellent. And that ADR has a lot of research around it, that it's very beneficial to a community and just people to sit there and have a discussion and friendship with a mediator. However, there's also a lot of research that mandatory ADR is not quite so successful. The Schneider Institute, having taken numerous classes and having a lot of friends who are the faculty there, they almost uniformly mandatory arbitration, mandatory mediation. Actually, most mediators are taught, you do not, if a party doesn't want to be there, the mediator should not be able to compel them because at that point they become an arbitrator. So, I think mandatory ADR is not considered best form. And personally, I would agree with that in terms of if parties don't want to be there, based on the code, you have the hearing process. And it's being given an option for those who wish to have a different process. From having sitting through the wrap-up last year, I was really, really pleasantly actually shocked and really liked. People were saying, oh, they came with creative solutions that the student felt they learned more from, that the student actually appreciated. I mean, it gave people more control into what their outcome was from both sides. I remember Vin from your office was just talking about someone who made a video about what happened when they think they had stolen something from Cornell store. And just how they said they got a lot out of that and actually they learned something. And I'm sitting there, this is exactly what the code should be in its best form. And I think so, ADR is excellent. I think personally it should stay under the code. If the Dean of Students wants to have other ADR things that aren't the code, I also welcome, because I think ADR is a good solution for people who are willing to do it. In terms of the Dean of Students and this kind of code, I know there's some talk from the president's side of, putting more adjudication under the Dean of Students. I think it's, and actually one of the recommendations in this report is to change it to the campus code of conduct to the Cornell or the community code of conduct. And I think that is emblematic of the working group who's saying, this is our statement of values. This is our statement of shared norms. And putting it in the students, in essence, does not seem to accord with that. Obviously, it's a larger discussion. But the working group recommendation was to say it should be, the code should be expanded in terms of its breadth to make it more clear that it can apply that applies to the community, and also a discussion about how does it apply if you take it off campus. In terms of the quantum proof, I would just note the JCC isn't here. Their office's position has always been they want a higher standard proof. The law school is an academic break. That's it, 90% of students aren't here. I'm here for another reason, but most law students aren't here, so I know they'd like to weigh in if we're going to have that discussion, when we have a discussion. But I think a lot of it also goes in terms of transparency of cases, to Joe's point. Hearing board cases are publicly archived. I've gone through them many times. They're very interesting to read. I've talked with hearing board members who I know. I never saw them up with people who I know who live together on the hearing boards about just their general experience with the boards and how they see cases going. Never in detail, of course, to work on other confidentiality. There really is a lot of ensuring that, the JCC's point of view in the past, and I can't speak on what the current JCC said, was the current code is quasi-criminal. We adjudicate things as marijuana, underage drinking, things that in the that if outside our system would be potentially criminal violations or low-level ones. And the sanctions are not just purely monetary damages, they're expulsion, they have a long-term record such that it fits somewhere in the middle between a civil adjudication where a monetary award isn't necessarily that bad, all the way up to, if you assault somebody, you can still be under our code, which is, if it's outside us, it'd be absolutely criminal. And I think Teresa's point is, we have slightly reduced due process, but also we're dealing with quasi-criminal nature, and therefore, the ACC's point in the past has been, it's appropriate to have an elevated quantum proof because we're dealing with offenses that could be criminal if outside our system. And I guess, finally, I just want to say, this is an excellent discussion. I'm happy to talk with anyone offline further. I'm happy to connect you with people on campus faculty. I know in the ILR, Teresa's and I also know them all well. But whether that be JCC, people who've gone through this process, it's important, I think, to have the full picture because I think everyone is united by desire to have code do the best it can and what's best for the campus community. Of course, there are a lot of disagreements, but I think it's important to have discussions. So thank you.
I just have a kind of clear a couple language things that we've been talking about. So the first one, think about the code of kind of actually is an ADR resolution because it's a non-criminal resolution. So when we talk about that, I think sometimes we forget about the fact that somebody gets caught with underage drinking, they're not going to the criminal proceeding. And so the code itself is an alternative dispute resolution. It's probably close to arbitration, but the weird thing is that no sanction in our office can be compelled by the JA. And I think that's a part that people forget about this code, is that the JA had almost no power in our system. The student either has to agree to the sanctions or the Harriet Board imposes it. And so another thing I think we should remember is that 99% of the cases are settled by an SDA. The student's like, yep, this is reasonable for me, I agree with this. And so when we talk about transparency, I think we also have to be really careful about the fact is that students have forever rights not to disclose this information, and they choose not to. My annual report talks about all the sanctions that we do, and I'm happy to have an in-depth conversation if you want to see some of these things, but I think people forget about the amount of learning that comes. And this is because I get to read all the essays that people write into that, and they have really fruitful realizations that I hated this process, but I learned a lot because this was the first time someone told me to come. And so I think we just have to be mindful of that. I think a couple things as we're starting to move forward also with language. And so we're a private institution, so we don't follow due process. We have fundamental fairness. I know that sounds a little bit different to make sure that we use the proper language, but we need to because we're not a public institution. So as we're having these conversations, you know, we don't sentence people, we sanction them. They're not guilty, they're responsible, they're not defendants, they're respondents. And so I just want to make sure, because we want to have this conversation in the educational administrative setting and not our criminal. And then I know I have a couple things that I want to say, but I like some of the changes that you guys did with the additional language and adding public mission values and service and climate. And so there's a lot of things that I do like in this thing. But as we spend the next couple weeks, as we think about where we're going from this, I think we need to identify some of the values that we think are important. One of the things that I've been really challenged this year and this past year is veracity. We have a lot of respondents coming in being completely disingenuous. And so I think we need to say, especially as a research institution, honesty and truthfulness needs to be something that's important to us. So I think one of the areas where this committee could really have some input is to try and create a list of some of these values. Integrity, veracity, tabloid, and so forth. And also I think it's important, a lot of the listservs that I sit on are really looking at some of these proposed OCR rules and regulations with the Boston administration. And what it seems like is that all protected classes are going to be grouped in. So they're saying that you just can't have gender basis kind of separate. You need to have race and all the other protected classes. And so I think when we talk about grade 6.4, I think the idea of talking about what it looks like for the protected classes in one scope. But again, I think as we have that conversation, do we want to be a community where you have to reach 75% of being a poor community member? Or do we want to say we value all community members? And so we're going to have a little bit of a lower standard so that we can say, if you're treated poorly, it doesn't just need to be egregious. It can be problematic for it to be addressed. And again, talking about that. But I really think we have a lot of time spent with thinking about the values that we want to recommend.
Choose some of the reasons.
I think Reese got there first, and I'll be after him.
Okay.
Just briefly on the language issue, and I haven't talked about this before. I don't use the term due process to only mean constitutional due process. It would be American Association of University Professors, the AAP, which is the organization that I'm active with and the general counsel for, use the term academic due process. So people want to tack on something like academic due process. It's all right with me, but I'm not giving up the concept of due process simply because somebody else doesn't want to use it. To me, it carries a meaning that we can adopt just as free speech. You know, we use terms about freedom of speech on campus. Not because we're a public institution, but because we embrace those rights. And so, you know, their language matters, of course. And the reason that, you know, Michelle, I think that you're saying we shouldn't use that language matters if you want to have it be constructed with a certain vision in mind. So I don't think it's just technically let's use certain language because it's correct and
to use it. It's, we have choices about what language we use because language does matter. And something like due process is an idea, not just simply a question of is there state action and therefore the 14th Amendment, the first part of the 5th Amendment apply. So this is, I think, part of the broader discussion that we're going to have. And Jessica, I don't know why you think that ought to be grabbed.
Yeah, maybe the topic of that we are right in the term due process as by the conversation because it is something that we want to
have. Right. I think we should have a further discussion about it. I was just, you know, just thinking about the irony of the number of the honesty, of course.
Yeah.
What's the irony?
Of talking about it at this moment
politically.
Okay. I just want to throw mine out. When we talked a little bit about it being community code, I've always got your bugs and I've got my bugs. I've always wondered why we don't have the code enforceable off campus, because I can tell you right now my phone rings off the hook, and if they're clear, it's Cornell people misbehaving outside, and because of that standard of proof. It is difficult for them, people who are engaged in this community, to have some accountability. And that's all they're asking for, some accountability. Not, you know, lock them up and throw the key. So it has always caused me concern that a community would not want to follow the code off campus and not be held accountable to it. So I guess I just wanted to state for them. I'd like it to, if we're going to build this, let's build it broad, and because you do represent everybody.
Point of information. When you were saying, you said accountability, are you referring to the quantum proof or are you referring to the
no.
jurisdiction?
See, that's why I don't like language so much.
Yes.
Yeah. So that, but that is it. That is part of the issue. So people who are immersed in that language and use it on a daily basis can understand the nuances. But part of the reason why people are afraid to go to the J because they're going to get sentenced and they hear that as they're going to be, you know, kicked out of school. And all they were doing was, you know, they had liquor in their room. They're going to get kicked out of school for having liquor, right? It's just the way that we are trying to, we have uninformed youth coming in, and we're using high-level language that we've acquired over the years, and we haven't given them an opportunity to adapt and listen to the nuances of the language. It's as simple as somebody saying, oh, he's robbed. Well, you weren't robbed, you were burgled. And you were larceny, you know. I mean, I could do that all day, but they felt like they were robbed, and it really doesn't. I get that. So let's talk about it and let's see what we can attach to it. But I can see how those.
I think this is a point of information. Just, you did see that we have that provision, mm-hmm. that Terry Lynn here about reconsidering that issue of off campus.
Yeah, and I think especially as you get to the Greek communities, because some of them are Cornell and
yeah.
some of them are not, it really is going to open that discussion. And then you talk about other groups that are.
Yeah. I haven't read that language specifically in the report. What is stopping us from expanding the physical jurisdiction?
The code says it only applies on campus.
Unless it's
a serious violation.
Right, but then you talk about you have to define the serious violation,
yeah,
right? And 18 alcohol violations in a house that's now on a Greek annex, hypothetically speaking.
Yeah.
that you know, is bothering the neighborhood, those types of things. They're not really serious. They're not serious in the intent of the code. They're not assaults, they're not those types of things. But they are problematic, and we want to be able to have those conversations.
Are you raising your hand, Sean?
No, I had a question, but the chief answered the question.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't even try.
So, and actually, I completely agree on the language. I mean, the biggest revolution for me going to law school is the difference between assault and battery, and it's not what people think it is. So I completely agree that language, I mean, I think to a degree's point, when I would use the word due process, I'm not, yes, there's constitutional due process. Yes, we are private, although there are some court cases, like, for instance, our board has to have open session when dealing with the contract colleges, and there's a court case. Cornell's unique. I think we'll leave it there. But to me, it's an idea of, I mean, to me, fundamental fairness due process, I am using them somewhat interchangeably, that to me, the process should be fair, you have procedural protections. I agree that we need to, in terms of discussion, it can be confusing, and we should try to get around that. It actually reminds me, You may remember when we were looking at having a community bill of rights a couple of years ago. I found a number here. Back then, there was a pamphlet from 1981 given to all new students saying, it's like the who, what, where, when, and why of Cornell policies, the code, all the, and as it goes through, it's 15 pages, and it explains it. Talks about some of Cornell's values. Talks about, oh, here's the JA. Here's how the action mentions the UA. Here's how the code is amended. And I actually found, I found it over the break. Actually, President Pollack had asked for a copy of it because I mentioned to her, oh, this thing is old, but it might be informative in terms of something to give out. I'm going to be scanning it over the next couple days. I'm not sure if it's perfect for this, but I'd be happy to share it with this committee in terms of just, here's what we did 30, 40 years ago, but at least an idea of, okay, we used to do something like this. Why move away from it? What can we potentially look at and say, okay, where are we? I guess the last portion is in terms of the hearing boards. I really would encourage people to look at the hearing boards. You can stop by the office of JA, they're publicly accessible. They are really thoughtful. I mean, you can tell the boards spend a lot of time, you'll occasionally get a dissent, but they really don't sit there and just kind of wave their hands around. They're trying to think through, they're trying to understand the consequences for everyone. And from what, at least in my anecdotal experience reading them, a lot of times the board, I go through hearing, a lot of times the person's not responsible. It's just sanctioning. I mean, it's interesting to look at. You can see the sets, you can see their hearing board, whoever into a review board, it's all there. And I really just encourage you to look at the public record. I don't personally, a lot of people don't. I really think it's, it would help a lot of people look at the board just to really understand how it all works. But I just, it's the last plug, is really look at it. I mean, it was informative to me. And I mean, I've been involved with maybe too long, but it was really informative. I started looking at them more in depth to try and see, okay, how does the rubber meet the road?
If you're bored in your pajamas tonight, the annual report from last year is now on the website. We're slowly updating, so all the public records from that academic year. Okay, so okay. We're gonna.
I would actually look forward to that. Just down here.
I think on Michelle's point of language, I think it's really important, like what Kathy said, really, I think at the end of the day, like, if you're a first-year undergraduate student, like, you just want to know, like, what can I do, what can't I do, and what happens if I accidentally make a mistake? I think that's the really important part, and that's why I like your sign outside of your office. That's, like, it's similar to criminal, but we don't use the same language. It's kind of, it's like this nice little happy land, like, and that's what works really well for students, because I see it all the time as an RA. You have a student that comes up to you and like, this happened to me, I don't really know what I'm doing, blah, 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 X, Y, and Z happened to me. And you're like, it's okay. Like, you just sit there as an RA, you're like, literally nothing's going to happen to you. Like, you're fine. And I think that's kind of what I want to encourage. And on, like, the pamphlet idea, we still have that. All first-year students are giving, like, this giant plastic packet that has all the great resources on it. Like, RAs, their doors are, like, decked out. Like, I think, like, that's type of the thing that we get, and as you get close, as you leave that first year community, as you leave these residential halls, then it comes back and it's like, who do I come to now? And so I think the language is important, but I also think at the same time, realizing that at the end of the day, this code is interpreted by the longest of faculty members at the university and the newest of undergraduates. And that confusion is very much apparent in the campus code of conduct. And it's also, I think, just for general discussions, really important that once language is solidified around an idea, the language is consistent, because I think that's really important. Because I know all the time, it's like, you know, every RA, what does getting a JA mean? It's like, well, nothing, because it doesn't exist. And so I think that for a lot is dispelling the narratives of students, of members of the Cornell community in the code, I think is super important. But that's just my final parting shot.
With that, we have 2 minutes left on the scheduled meeting. Anybody have any final comments?
And so I know last meeting you shared that you and Matt were going to kind of work on some timelines for the code revision. I'm getting really worried about the time because we're taking a full break. And we're finally getting the recommendation of kind of a full code revision. And so I'm curious about your
all's
conversation as a follow-up.
I think that we didn't quite have that yet, because we were waiting on this final report. At least I was waiting on this final report, because I didn't know a lot of this was going to be implemented. And I'm going to honestly say I don't know exactly how we should move forward, and that's something that we will have to discuss with many members of the committee and make recommendations on, because there are a lot of different areas that we are getting input for how we should move forward. Some of them are conflicting, so we have to decide which ones we're agreeing with that. And where
we can start. Yeah, I just two things. One, I just like to formally note on the record our appreciation to the working group. I know I thank them a lot, but really, it's just huge undertaking. And this community is often very, very easy to criticize and very low to get thanked for praise. So I just want to make sure that the bucket is clearly in terms of code, looking at the code, Dale and I did have a conversation. We're hoping are going to have another one. I have some stuff that we started last year that I've been working on that I'm going to share with Dale, and we can bring this committee at the next meeting. I put it on some, I think, right at time. But I'm happy to talk with you offline in terms of just everything you'd like, because I think it's we need the large stakeholder involvement. And even as you start working with, it takes, I mean, to do a good job with a lot of people a lot of time, and I agree. You look at it, we're already over a quarter, coming up on a quarter way through the year, so time is ticking.
No, I think we probably want to schedule sometime before or
Well, it is four, but you know, it's one of those things.
I don't think we know yet, but probably one or two this semester when they decide what we want community input on. Because there are so many things here would be great with community input, but we can't discuss every single one of the issues with the code with everyone. That's what we're going to design. We're going to design what we want community to put on and where we're going to start. And that's what we're going to do by the next meeting. So if you want input on that, talk to Matt, talk to myself, talk to the UA executive committee. Of course, I've definitely want to sit down with you sometime in the next 2 weeks. And we're going to come with a plan probably in 2 weeks. And you can absolutely give input, but that's we're out of time.
Can I make just a quick suggestion? I have thought when we were talking about when we're going to have meetings, that there was some possibility of having sort of not official meetings on the off weeks, and so that maybe next Wednesday would be a good day for those who want to come to be part of that conversation about a timeline. Just seemed like it, you know, it fits into what you're talking about.
I can request the office days on this for next Wednesday, and I think that was a great idea.
Yes. And that's what we tried to do last year. They all became formal meetings. If you don't want them to become formal meetings again.
Right.
I can tell you, last year burned me the heck out.
Yeah,
but I think
I would absolutely be in favor of that. It would be all of us sitting in a room with chalkboards or whiteboards or something and actually discussing these amendments rather than we sit here with the speakers list. Not actually being able to have a real discussion.
You guys can't get a room
in Jay's office.
Yeah, we can't get a room. We'll sugar you up.
And you have been officially added to the committee, so congratulations.
Yay!
Welcome. Assembly needs to vote on it.
Staffing.
Yeah. All right.
You're on the staff.
Yes, I am.
Where is the executive?
You do
I'm not to vote for myself.
Oh, no.
I won't be able to make it next week, but if you want, I can see if Scott's available for continuity purposes.
That would be fantastic.
Good to see Scott again.
Yeah, I'll see if he's available. It's kind of late.
That's terrific.
Actually, he's probably not
going
to say that.
Oh,
it's good. I'll tell you.